Hello and welcome to Contramundum. I am Andrew Isker, and with me is our co-host CJ Engel. Today we are going to continue our discussion of The Christian Prince from Stephen Wolfe's A Case for Christian Nationalism. And so before we begin, how are you, CJ? What's new?
Good. I'm preparing for a very significant change in my life that I cannot wait to share with the general public. So I'm busy. And
you're not transitioning, are you?
I am transitioning, but not my bodily integrity.
That's good. That's good. I didn't want everyone watching to be worrying. Good morning to those of you like Paul in Australia. He's probably asleep right now. And good afternoon to everyone else. But thank you for joining us. And yeah, not much new for me other than, you know, I was late for, you know, CJ was sitting backstage waiting for me because my wife was having an ultrasound for the baby. And so, the baby will be here soon enough, in a couple weeks, hopefully. So,
are you guys going to choose its gender?
No, that's been chosen for us. We know that it's a boy. So very excited for another little guy. Yeah. Yeah. So
it's got a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, a couple of weeks until he's due, and be praying for us and for him and for my wife. Let's see. Forms Respector here says, "How do I get live streams to do 2x speed?" We'll just talk twice as fast. That's what we'll do.
Yeah, you could also just. I would suggest quitting your job and watching streaming Contramundum
full time. Yeah, we'll put forth more content just for that. Without further ado, we'll jump back in. We were going in through Wolfe's book on the Christian Prince. So we made it through the first three sections. It's a long chapter, but very, very good. And so we're at part four. If you're reading along at home, I'm sure all of you have your own copy. So to pull that out, if you're driving, don't do that.
By the way, just to like set this up, the timing of this couldn't be better because I mean, obviously people have seen that there's a little bit of, since last time we did this, first of all, yeah. Doug Wilson was on Tucker, which is really cool. Deal. Regardless of little skirmishes, that's cool. That's exciting. That's a white.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And then Stephen Wolfe has slight disagreements with Wilson, and then James White started getting involved. So the timing of this couldn't be better because I think the Christian Prince is actually a singular area where the differences between that camp and Stephen Wolfe are at their most profound. So this is a really good chapter to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're exactly right. Like, I don't know if everyone has paid attention to those fights on, you know, Doug kind of responded to Stephen saying, you know, both and kind of thing, because classic Doug, of course, but because one of Doug's main points is that the problems we have that he made for Tucker, the problems we have are spiritual problems, not political ones. And in a sense, of course, that's true. Obvious. Everyone can see that all around us. But in another sense, the political problems we have are political problems, can be solved with politics. I mean, for instance, you see massive crime all over all of our major cities. That's a political problem that can easily be solved with politics. You just put criminals in jail or execute justice in whatever form you think is appropriate and just. And so that's easily solvable, right? And that is a change. I mean, it can change through preaching of the gospel and so forth, but that's not the only means to changing that, right? It's just wielding power. And so that's a big part of it. And one of Stephen's points that he's been making on Twitter, and you made this as well, see, just preach the gospel to the gang, to the gangsters. Yeah. One of his points is that we've become allergic to any application of power, right? That is like in the post-war consensus, mark your bingo cards. I said it, it has become something that we simply think is anti-Christian to wield power in a righteous way. Even like today, I was kind of, I didn't want to do this. I'm like, I can't do it, but I gotta say it. I saw Scott Annual is up to goofy tricks about Psalm 110 and its application in 1 Corinthians 15:25, where it says Jesus will reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet. And like guys in the we lose down here camp, what they want to do is say that no, Jesus isn't reigning. His reign is totally spiritual. There's no manifestation of that in the material world in which we live, because red power is bad. We can't have Christians wielding power. That's ultimately like the reason why they take that exegetical track. And so, right, they have a conclusion in that they need to work through to get there. It's already figured out. They're like, oh, the verse can't be saying that because we already know Jesus doesn't want us to have power. And it's just straightforwardly obvious. Jesus reigned, like Basileos, is just the word for king, like the verbal form of king in Greek. Like, how do you have a king that doesn't wield, like, reigning literally means wielding power. That's what reigning means. So how could you not have that in some sense? Obviously it's spiritual in the sense that he's up in heaven reigning, but it has an effect on the real world in some way. It has to. How could it not? Why would Paul say that otherwise? Why would the Bible say that? So anyway, but you see this worked out, the same principle that Stephen has, because Stephen and I have totally different eschatology, and but we end up kind of in the same place, because instead of having this cope of, no, Christians can't wield political power, we just have to have this gradual slight change throughout millennia through the preaching of the gospel, which is a lot of post-mill people take that position. And that's kind of a cope to say, then we don't have to have kings that wield power or rulers or presidents or whatever system you're in. And so Stephen really gets to this stuff in this chapter. And yeah, you're right, CJ. It is perfectly timely because it's become controversial now. And I think it really drives a lot of the disagreements within the Christian nationalist camp, or even just the rightist, or Christians on the right in general, the relation of the Christian to political power, right? Disagreements mm-hmm. over that. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, what's your read on it in terms of, you know, not only Doug, but James White and even other guys that are, you know, much less friendly than they are to us.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been saying this for a while that, like, I do consider us allies. I mean, but it's important to understand that there are methodological differences and there are also practical differences. I just gave an analogy online about, like, is it appropriate to use political power to seize the endowments, like Harvard University's endowment, since they're using this capital to fund a left-wing cultural revolution in America through the university system. Well, I don't think that you can find legal precedents for that in the Mosaic civil law.
Yeah.
And if your methodology is so there's a lot of libertarian type theonomists, like, you know, the guys I'm talking about, like John Reese or whatever his name is. They have more of a libertarian flavor of theonomy because they're right. You can't find the application of like seizing endowments. You can't find that in the Mosaic civil law. It's completely true. Yeah.
I can maybe try that. If a city in ancient Israel is apostatizing, you got to burn that thing down. That would be my proof text. But go on. Sorry.
Well, no, but you can't.
You really can't. Yeah, you're right.
No, you can't. But this is a really good example of something that Stephen Wolfe would have no problem with. This, like, theoretically, like, it's not. I don't want to speak for him on that specific issue, but that's a type.
Gotta have him on again so he can speak for himself.
I'm sure he would be okay with it, but I don't want to speak for him. But that's a good example of an issue where, there are state of emergencies, and there are moments where the political integrity is so important that you have to apply power to confront enemies. And you don't need to look for every precedent in the Mosaic civil law. So that's a really good example, I think, of the practical implications of the methodological differences here. So the idea of wielding power in these creative, unique, and situationalist ways, I think, is something that he's going to get to right here in The Christian Prince. So maybe we should keep going with that. But that's my general thought, is like, this is that, I always talk about the dynamic between the tension between universalism and particularism. I'm much more of a paleoconservative, you know, situationalist, because there are unique political threats that we have to use power to address. And I think The Christian Prince has that leeway.
Yeah, this T. James Boone has a good comment just to tie this up here in a bow. There are cope versions of each eschatology. Cope pre-mill, things will get worse, so don't even try to rule. Cope post-mill, all peoples will eventually be Christianized, so wait until then before ruling. And cope amillennial, things will more or less be the same until the end, so don't try to make them better, right? Yeah, every single one of these, and all of them are perfectly situated to adapt themselves to the prevailing order that has existed since the Second World War, right? Mm-hmm. That's what these are, right? That's why, I mean, Nate Fisher made this point months ago when he came on the show, that it's fascinating that two guys that like can't stand each other at all and have like totally opposite views within the Reformed world in R. Scott Clark and Andrew Sandlin, right? They are, oh yeah, thumbs up. R. Scott Clark and Andrew Sandlin, like these guys are complete opposites, right? One is R2K, the other is Theonomic. And they all end up, they both of them end up having the same practical political theology despite being 180 degrees different on paper. Right. Yeah. Why is that? Because they're both adapting their views to the post-war consensus world. And so, right. But this chapter does not adapt itself to that whatsoever. It's rooted in historic Reformed political theology. Yeah. And this is what Stephen says, is that, right, all these guys are like, oh yeah, I'm totally with Calvin on all these doctrinal things, 100% all the way. Or Calvin or Turretin or Bob, whoever your theologian of choice is. But then you get into their political theology. It's like, not that though. No, can't do that. And so this is the area, like in The Lion King, CJ will love this reference, right? The Lion King, where they're standing on the rock, is like, what about that dark area over there? Can I go? No, don't go there, Simba. Well, we're going there today. So
yeah.
Without further ado, this is page 284 of Wolf's book, A Divine Office. The prince, as a civil leader, holds an office on behalf of God, the creator. Quote, the principal and supreme end of the civil magistrate as such, writes Turretin, is the glory of God, the creator, conservator of the human race, and the ruler of the world. It is a natural office required by the nature of man, whose function is ordering civil society for commodious and pious living. Civil power being original to God, the prince mediates God's divine civil rule. He is not a steward, nor a simple administrator, as if he simply promulgates a divinely prescribed civil code. Rather,
he makes... Okay, this right here.
Yeah, pause right there.
Okay. This is very specifically what I've been saying. And like, I know you have theonomic roots, and I don't know how you feel about it, but this, I think, regardless of where you come down on it, this is an important distinction that for Stephen Wolfe, for the magisterial reformers like Turretin and Rutherford and others like that, the purpose of the king is to rule, not merely administer divinely given law. I mean, the idea that this is okay. This is the moment where politics is more fundamental than law, that law is downstream from politics. This is precisely what he is saying, that law is not something that we find given to us for all time, and that it is the job of a bureaucrat to come through and apply the law in the best way he can, but rather that he exists outside of the civil society and he mediates between the power of God and the civil order and uses law as a tool to rule the people that God has given to him. That's Christian nationalism.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what, and that's just, this is again, classical Protestant political theory.
It is. Yeah.
This is what they believed. It's not just some like crazy right wing guy that decided he wanted to concoct some theories. Like this is a tradition that has been handed down over centuries that Stephen is picking back up.
He is.
That has been neglected for reasons. And so,
many reasons.
Many reasons. Yeah. You're right. I mean, this is a huge point that the king rules, and he rules because, or whatever we use king, uses prince, the president rules, the deep state rules because he's given power by God.
Yeah. So politics matters. And law is going to reflect the character of the political class, the elites. Law reflects their ethos.
Yes, precisely. So continuing on.
Keep going. Yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay. Interrupt me whenever. This is all great. Rather, he makes public judgments in application of God's natural law, effectively creating law through derivative of natural law, and he has the power to bring about what he commands. Thus, the prince holds the most excellent office, exceeding even that of the church minister, for it is most like God. The prince, unlike the... I know this.
Have you seen the you know that gif of like Andre the Giant? Like, I always think of that. Anyway, go ahead.
The prince, unlike the church minister, and this is, but he cites Turretin here, is a mediator, mm-hmm. a vicar of God in outward civil affairs. Right. Footnote, with regard to spiritual good, Christ is the sole mediator between God and man. And thus church ministers are instruments of spiritual good, but not mediators of it. Right. He's drawing, very carefully making this point, as the reformers did, mm-hmm. that, right, pastors, bishops, priests, whatever, you know, terminology you use for the shepherds of the church, ministers of the church, they cannot be the spiritual mediators between God and men, mm-hmm. because only Christ is. But a mediator of power, right? Who is that's something God has given to men.
Yeah, this is why Stephen's a two kingdomer. You know, not a modern two kingdomer, but this is why he's a classic two kingdomer, because Christ himself has no mediator to his elect people. He works directly with each individual justified man. But when it comes to Christ's rule over civil society, he uses kings as mediators. The power flows from Christ to the ruler, to the people. And so therefore that mediator is a vicar of God. That's the meaning of vicar of God, a mediator. And I don't think a lot of people appreciate the significance of talking about power in that way.
Yeah. He goes on, as Calvin said, civil rulers, quote, represent the person of God as whose substitutes they in manner act. Right. And this is Calvin's point. Like, you read through the Institutes and he makes this point over and over and over again, not just in the final chapter on civil magistrates, but all throughout, right? When he's contrasting civil power and the power of laws, right? Civil laws to bind men with what the Roman Catholic Church was doing. And so it's right there. Like, he's not making these things up out of whole cloth, right? There is a tradition here. You could go back and, as Stephen likes to say, do the reading, right? It's there if you want to. Continuing on. For this reason, the prince is called a god in Scripture, Psalm 82:6. He has, as Calvin said, a sacred character and title. In a sense, we see God in the magistrate. Rutherford says, for example, that the king hath a politic resemblance of the king of the heavens, having a little god, and so is above any one man. Calvin likewise states that when good magistrates rule, we see God, as it were, near us and governing us by means of those whom he hath appointed. Elsewhere he writes that the image of God shines forth in them when they execute judgment and justice. The dignity of civil rulers is so great in Calvin's view that even the, quote, palaces of princes ought to resemble a sanctuary, for they occupy the dwelling place of God, which ought to be sacred to all, unquote. The comment is fascinating, especially in light of Calvin's efforts to lock church buildings to suppress superstitions. Calvin demonstrates the divine magnitude of the princely office, especially in terms of presence in relation to the people. Having the highest office on earth, the good prince resembles God to the people. Indeed, he is the closest image of God on earth.
Yeah, let me just pause there. So this is actually really powerful, because in my own development, like coming away from libertarianism and learning to appreciate the function that the state has in civil society. Yeah. I mean, I have that essay titled The Triumph of the Political, and I begin to realize that what is unique about the 20th century is not the existence of power, but the flavor of power, that the managerial state is not the same as the magisterial state. And so that when we talk about the goodness of power, that the fact that the prince represents God, and we sort of infuse it with the language of deity. I mean, that's what he's saying here. He's a vicar of God, and he actually represents, reflects, and mirrors God. I mean, that's the language of deity. And so we have this very libertarian impulse to oppose that because we've seen how bad and evil the state has been in the 20th century. And yeah. we forget the fact that politics is still important, even if the particular totalitarianism that we're facing is so egregious today. The solution to that cannot be some sort of anarchical model.
No, like power is a constant, right? Mm-hmm. There's going to be political power wielded, right? That's what people have to get in their heads. I mean, that I think is the thing that drove me out of libertarianism is, well, there's just always going to be political power, right? Even like I would read Hans Hermann Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed, and his like anarcho-capitalist construct of covenant communities and things like that. And it's like, and I'd read it and like, you're just creating a state, right? You're not going to call it that. You're going to use some other term, but you're creating an ordered community where there is power wielded to maintain that order, right? You just created a state. That's what it is. And, mm-hmm. and so, so when you get through all of that and you realize there is going to be political power no matter what you do, then you look at it and think, okay, power is either going to be wielded well and wisely and justly and faithfully and godly men will wield it or ungodly people will, right? Mm-hmm. That's the determining thing. And
the cultural hegemony, the ability for men to be crafted and molded over time within society is downstream from first establishing that political order and yes. confronting and dealing with the enemies. And so therefore, liberty is something that can be earned over time by a people that have that hegemonic aspect of a good culture. And so therefore, you can't start with liberty and then any growth of the state is a deviance from liberty, but rather liberty comes about after power has been established. And this is like you're flipping yeah. classical liberalism on its head.
Yeah. Yeah. Hans Hermann Hoppe is based for sending us all on the post libtard path by Rusty Shackelford. Thank you. He is. Yeah. I still love him. I still think he's great, but he's a stepping stone into other things.
We can keep going. By the way, yeah. just for everyone listening, I only have half an hour left because I have a Chronicles recording after this. So
yeah, he does. We'll have a short. No. Keep interrupting. We'll just have a part three then. The divine presence in the prince speaks to his role beyond civil administration. Through him, as the mediator of divine rule, the prince brings God near to the people. The prince is a sort of national god, not in the sense of being divine himself, nor in materially transcending common humanity, nor as an object of prayer or spiritual worship, nor as a means of salvific grace, but as the mediator of divine rule for this nation and as one with divinely granted power to direct them in their national completeness. He embodies the people as one who, by divine power, executes their will for themselves. He is a master in the master's universe. The prince personifies their national spirit, unifies them under a mission, and inspires an intergenerational will to live. He directs men in fulfilling the dominion mandate to fulfill man's desire. He inspires noble action, sacrifice, and common affection, and he casts a vision for national greatness. Quote, we love all great men, unquote, says Thomas Carlyle. Quote, does not every man, true man, feel that he is himself made higher by doing reverence to what is really above him, unquote. The prince promotes national self-love and a manly moral liberty. He recognizes national sins, but swiftly resolves them, leaving no license for exploitation or room for lingering self-doubt and the lack of national self-confidence. He encourages and channels the boldness and spirit of youth while elevating the old and venerating the dead. He silences the social mammies and countenances the Spartan bootstrapper. He loves and enacts justice. He worships God and calls his people to do the same. As an embodiment of the people, he is the best of the people, a man reflecting both their image and God's image, signifying that they are God's and that they live in and for him. That is for God. With martial virtue, resolve, and thumos, he fights foreign aggressors, sacrificing himself for his people's good, and he establishes peace with other nations. In a word, he ought to be a great man, the hero of the people. As such, his death only solidifies the nation, creating a heroic past. As Ernest Reagan said, great men glory, I mean the general kind, that is the capital stock upon which one bases a national idea.
Yeah, you know, one of the things you'll find about like James White and others like that is they wouldn't speak about power in this way at all, not even close. They would feel very uncomfortable imputing the image of heroism into man.
Why don't you address this right here? It doesn't appear to believe in total depravity. No, I don't think he believes in absolute depravity. And no reform person does. Some do, unfortunately,
So, if you scroll through this guy's comments, I think he has a tendency to attribute sort of the American post-millennial views about man back into the Magisterial Reformation. One of the things about Stephen Wolfe's project is he's trying to recover that phrase Magisterial Reformation is really important here, because this was the thought of the reformers on the continent in the 1600s. This is not the thinking of the 18th century American Puritans. This is a totally different type of Reformation political theology. And so they wouldn't teach that man is like every single work that he does is evil at all times. They would teach that man is incapable of achieving righteousness and achieving heaven on their own, but that man is still, because grace perfects nature, nature is still usable to produce good societies. Theonomists and Puritan types on Twitter, like James White and Doug Wilson, they don't agree with Stephen Wolfe on these things, but Stephen does believe that good societies can come about through political engagement. He does believe that, and that's not a denial of total depravity. It's an affirmation of a different style of total depravity that a lot of us are used to talking about. So yeah, Stephen's really hesitant about things like absolute depravity, but he is on board with the more classical version of it.
Yeah, you can see this just in history, right? Can functional societies exist? Like, can non-Christians create functional working society? Well, of course they can. And they have, right? So those are people who are totally depraved, right? That they sin, and sin messes things up and affects things. But nevertheless,
this is completely false. I think that part of his view is that like man does want to be free, and like what you get from that is like this total like licentious view of like society, like that's and that instinct needs to be repressed by power. I think he definitely believes in the depravity of man, and he also believes that you have to use power to slow this down. Power, the intention of power is to confront depravity. It's not a denial of total depravity at all. But there are good men and there are better men, and some men are better than others, and some men are more righteous than others. And that's what he's describing here as the Christian prince. That's what the definition of a good prince is the man who leads people morally, because not all people are on the same plane ethically at all. And that's that strikes at the egalitarian instincts that a lot of us were born with,
which is part of this chapter too. So we'll get to that. So I'll finish this part off, and then you can read the next one, CJ. It goes without saying that though the prince is a national god in this lowercase sense, he does not and indeed cannot mediate salvific grace. Right. And this is something people he's very careful to point out, because people will say when he's operating as a mediator, they'll be like, you're saying that the prince saves people, like constantly. You see this.
It's stupid that he has to write this. He has to write this because his critics are dumb.
Yeah, exactly. No earthly office has such power, and Christ alone is the mediator of grace unto eternal life. Nevertheless, the prince, even as a mediator of divine civil rule, is an instrument for eternal life, right? The prince administers things for the complete good, for both earthly and heavenly good, and he orders the former to the latter. He ensures both outward peace and the sort of civic dynamism that conduces to spirited, commodious, and pious living. Thus, one looks to the prince for his good, more to the prince for his good than even church ministers. Right, and this is one of the things Steven talks about a lot. Yeah. And some of it, like, if you just like stop and think for a second about how true it is, and this gets into like cultural questions about cultural Christianity, right? Is cultural Christianity good or bad or whatever? It's like, it's good for children to be raised in a Christian home. And mm-hmm. the micro scale of this, like, who is the Christian prince of the family? Well, the father is. And he yeah. orders the family, and he does all these things. He ensures outward peace and the sort of civic dynamism that conduces to spirited, commodious, and pious living, right? He has the family worship together and all these things.
Don't picture Donald Trump here. Picture King Alfred. Like, this yeah. is what he, like, he's a man who leads his people. And the man who leads his people operates as at the helm of a different kingdom than the pastor. Yeah. That's what he's trying to get at here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And he, the footnote here is important because this is what he says all the time too. We expect far too much from ministers today, though pastors often have great wisdom and insight in earthly things, including politics and ethics. Their role as ministers in the life of Christians is administering the sacred means for the good of the soul. Ministers should redirect us from things of this world and fix our eyes on Christ in heaven, not lead social programs or drive our hearts downward. Their office is holy because they offer us holy things for higher life to come. And that's so incredibly true. And I mean, he's right in one sense, right? His solution to all the, because you see all of the like pastors, like especially in 2020, right? Where they're talking about racial justice and Black Lives Matter and all of these things, and how systemic racism is the thing. They get into all of this stuff, and they have a clue about anything, or even just like the SBC begging Mike Johnson to send billions of dollars to Ukraine, right? The same thing. Like, I would much rather they don't talk about these things ever than do those things. That's worse, actually. Even though there are many good pastors that do have their heads on straight and understand politics and culture and ethics and so forth, but their job is to administer word and sacrament, right? That's their job. It's not to rule. And so he's right in that sense. Though pastors are essential, back to the main text, of course, the prince establishes the conditions for a peaceful and quiet life in all godliness. And this footnote, I'm reading all the footnotes too, because you got to read them. Elizur Goodrich, a Congregationalist pastor ministering in Connecticut in the American founding era, said the following: the immediate ends of the magistracy and ministry are different, but not opposite. They mutually assist each other and ultimately center in the same point. The one has for its object the promotion of religion and the cause of Christ. The other immediately aims for the peace and order of mankind in this world, without which there could be no fixed means of religion, nor the church have continuance on earth. But through the interposition of a miraculous providence constantly displayed for its preservation. Hence, the Church of Christ will have no fixed residence where there is no civil government until he, whose right it is, shall take to himself his great power and reign King of Nations, even as he is King of Saints. And so, back to the main text. This has always been the duty, whether man were in a state of integrity or state of sin, to direct outward man to his complete good. Indeed, nothing changed at the fall with regard to the principles or ends of his office. Only the means changed. The prince mediates divine rule both by a sort of divine presence or gravitas and in civil judgment. For the latter, the prince is the instrument by which natural law becomes human law. The prince enlivens laws not as an agent of coercion, but as the divinely sanctioned vicar of God who binds conscience to just applications of natural law as one who directs public reason. So there we go.
There we go.
Right. That's pretty straightforward of the views. And you know, it shouldn't be so controversial, right?
Well, we
can understand this in the household.
Yeah, the controversy is healthy though. I think it challenges people's perceptions of power. And I think this type of controversy is extremely edifying. And I kind of came to these conclusions through a different angle, through reading Carl Schmitt and Paul Gottfried and stuff.
Yeah.
But I was also helped along by Stephen, and like, just because I always felt like I had this weird dynamic between my views and what I considered to be actual like Reformed political theology, which was either Theonomic or modern 2K. So I really appreciate Steven like really elucidating this as a historical option for us.
Exactly. That's all you had. You either had some variation of really perverted two kingdoms or like theonomy or Kyperianism as the only two options. Right. And so here's one where you can just believe what the reformers believed about civic power. So do you want to go ahead with the second half of this, this section? This will probably take us a little while. There's a lot to talk about.
Sure. This one is great men and egalitarianism. Our age suffers from a dearth of great men. Whoa. This is largely
you're telling me that for the first time.
let's reflect on that real quick. Even the idea of great men, heroic men, like you're not. I mean, is that a denial of total depravity? Like that? That's what you'll get out of that. So our age suffers from a dearth of great men. This is largely because acquiring power and influence requires one to debase himself with egalitarian appeal. Yes. We live under a de facto gynocracy where masculinity is pathologized in the name of fairness and equity.
Yeah, let's pause right there. Like even just the point, like it's like just look at not even political power or economic power, but look at the church today, right? Who is at the top of all of our church hierarchies? Who has the biggest churches, right? Who sits on the boards and becomes seminary presidents and everything else, right?
It's either women or males.
New males, right? Men that have debased themselves, right? Yeah. Have given themselves over to the longhouse. That's the people that that rise to the top, because you have to. You can't still be a man and get to the top. I mean, you see this, the controversy, you know, this week with Mark Driscoll, right? And he's back in the news, right? And like, there's a guy, and everyone's gonna be like, yeah, he's disqualified for ministry. He's a bad guy. He's done all these things, horrible things. Sure. Well, I'll take that at face value. We'll say that's true. I don't know enough about it to know. Like, he's never given his side of the story, so I have no opinion. But, right, there's a guy who was able to build this big empire in Seattle and still largely acted like a man, even though, he would trash men all the time, too. He had to, right? If he was going to say anything like, pro-patriarchal, he'd have to, like, beat up guys 15 different times to say one good thing. So even in him, you see this, right?
Yeah.
But like those guys don't rise to the top ordinarily, right? They get they get smacked down. Like they don't even try to. I mean, that's the thing I've said a million times. But you know, guys like us or guys watching our stream or whatever, anyone that is connected to our world, those are not. They don't even go to seminary or like because they know I'm going to take on a whole bunch of debt and I have to kowtow to the longhouse and be a good little boy and play all these games in order to have a career. And who would sign up for that? Who would want to do that and still have any self-respect, any integrity? Yeah. So no, it's not possible in this world unless we build things that are counter and alternatives. So continue on, CJ.
Yeah, to achieve acceptance or relevance today, men must become female adjacent. That is to adjust to toxic feminine conditions of empowerment, sameness, credentialism, risk aversion, victimology, and passive aggression. Mediocrity today is barely concealed by institution-dependent accolades. Therapy and self-care are praised as an achievement. Struggle and self-willed action are deemed toxic. Competition, agonistic assertion in the pursuit of concrete achievement threaten the egalitarian regime.
Yeah, let's stop there again. Sorry, this is when we're going to stop a lot. But you still got 10, 15 minutes.
I'm fine. Yeah. So I mean, and this is worth getting into detail about. Yeah. It's easy for us to critique therapy culture, but I don't know if you've noticed this. Just like upon self-reflection, like you recognize the fact that you've absorbed our female adjacent world, like all of the priorities, the way we have to speak to our children, the way we have to speak to our wives, we have to walk on eggshells with people at church. Nothing is masculine. Everything is about safety and emotions and self-care. It's like very pampering and degrading for men.
Yeah, you can't speak frankly ever to anybody. Yeah. Right? You can't just say, no, this is wrong. You're wrong. I'm right. Yeah. You're wrong. Let's have it out. You can't do that. Like, you'll be treated, especially like in the church, right? If you just have a frank discussion and you stick to your guns and you speak with authority about what you believe, you'll be destroyed, right? And you'll be called, oh, you're so unchristlike. You're so unchristlike because you're not talking like a woman, right? That's what happens. Like, you can't just be like, this is what's true. Here's where you're wrong. Let's have an argument. And yeah, may the best man win.
An example of this is like, this is kind of a petty example, but it really ticked me off. So I got pulled over the other day in California. And
this is a good example.
I had the kids in the back of my like Ford F, like it's a 1990 Ford F-150. Like it's super redneck. Yeah. It's extremely based, but I had the kids in the back, not even in the bed, but just in the cab. And they didn't have like their booster required, because in California, like they'd have to have booster. And I got pulled over.
You
gotta
wrap them in bubble wrap. Yeah.
Right. And the ladies, you know, it's a lady cop, of course. Right. So she like
hope
scolded
you had bulletproof vest.
Exactly. I was thinking of that the whole time. But I was like, she scolded me for not like caring about the safety of my kids. And I'm like, you know what? Like, I grew up in the, like literally on the highway in the back of my dad's truck. And I just, this safetyism that pervades every aspect of our totalitarianism, it's so degrading and demoralizing. And like, this was a couple weeks ago. So I was like, you know what, kids, like, we don't belong here anymore. You know, we don't belong in Newsom land. And it's not even Newsom land. It's like the entire feminine regime.
Oh, it's that way here too. It's horrible. Yeah. It's so bad. And it's exactly right. You see, like, you see this online all the time too, where, right, if you reply to someone and you don't dress it up with, brother, you may be incorrect here on this point, and I love you and respect you and you're a good man. Like, if you don't dress it up that way, people will be like, you're arrogant and a jerk. If you just say, hey, I think you're wrong about this. Yeah. Here's why. Right. Yeah. You're not allowed to do that. Oh no. What an arrogant guy. So unchristlike. No, just be a man. Yeah. Right. Just say what you think. And if you're wrong, admit you're wrong and get it right. Right. That's what men do. And you're not allowed to do that ever. It's, and you see this, like these points here. Right. Mediocrity today is barely concealed by institution dependent accolades. Like, you look at the big EVA people, mm-hmm. right? You see the stuff that they like produce. Mm-hmm. They're mediocrities. They're not like impressive people at all.
Like, we all make fun of them for like they have a new book on like the threat of Christian nationalism. It's like literally the same book written like five different times from different people, and they get like big contracts and they get big reviews in the Washington Post, and because
they're selling books, never make any money.
They're institution dependent accolades, and that's what's trending. And so they just like regurgitate the same talking points time after time.
Yeah, all of like they're really mediocre people at the very top. That's what
they're scared. They're scared to lose their positions. They're scared of their comfortable incomes.
Well, I mean, we did you weren't here for it, but Chase and I did the stream on the Ligon Duncan interview, and he got the passage wrong. And this is like the top reforms guy ever. And he said, no, Jesus never said this. And he's like setting John the Baptist and Jesus against each other. He actually quoted Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like, you didn't know. He had no idea. and it's like, at first I didn't notice that either. I'm like, whoa. Yeah, he did. Yeah, man. Like, how? Like, these are mediocrities. These are not impressive people at all. And mm-hmm. you know, yeah, people, you know, want to be upset with Doug on different positions that he has and things that he's done lately. But like, Doug is a genuinely impressive guy. I mean, I know a person really bright guy. Agree with him
or on anything, but he's masculine and he's a man and he's standing up for what he, and that's what they hate. That's why they call it the Moscow move, you know?
And that's why I love him, because like he'll like disagree frankly and tell you you're wrong and you'll disagree with him. And it's like, and he's fine with it. Like he doesn't get insecure when you just, anytime I've disagreed with him on anything, it's not like he, like, cause if you do it with these guys, they'll be petty. They'll be backstabbers. They'll be like going behind the scenes to attack you. Like, you
see what they did. Those are all female traits. Those are all female traits.
You see what they did. They're talking about how they coordinated this thing with what's the egghead guy with the glasses. I have to be more specific. Who wrote the Moscow Mood piece? Kevin DeYoung. Like, they're talking about how they coordinated it behind the scenes, and they're working on this piece and doing all this stuff together. It's like, it takes all that work to just state an opinion. Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, you're doing all this stuff behind their backs and doing all these things. It's like, no, if somebody's got a problem with me in our world, just tell me and we can argue, and one of us will be right. And it's okay. And if you're wrong, and I think you're wrong, that's fine. Right. This is what men do. It's astounding. And so, like, therapy, self-care, praised and as an achievement. Right. I went to therapy and I got sorted everything out. My parents are bad people and I'm so good. Right. That and struggle, self-willed action, deep toxic. Like, competition is good. Yeah. Agonistic assertion is good. Fighting for what you think is right. That's good. You should do it. Yeah. All right. Continue on.
All right. Instead of analytical thought, viewpoints are backed by institutionally conferred credibility. And by and by threats of managerial bureaucratic reprisal for disagreement. Everything must be rigged for equitable outcomes, which suppresses spontaneous hierarchy formation. Masculinity is enlisted as a means to empower the female objects of empathy, the abstract marginalized, at the man's expense. As a result, Western nations are leading themselves into decline, especially demographically, as feminine empathy, which is suitable for the domestic sphere, enacts gynocratic contradictions as self-destructive inclusivist civil policies. Should I read the footnote?
In a second. I mean, so much of this too, like, elaborates the stuff we've been saying.
This is really powerful and it's very dense.
And so, like, it's worth unpacking a little bit more. But, like, you remember, you were homeschooled, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you don't remember, like, being on the playground and playing, like, football games?
So I actually did in first grade. I was in public school. So.
Okay. But this is what would happen is you would have spontaneous hierarchy formation right there on the playground, right? One kid was going to be the quarterback. Yeah. And you maybe would fight about it a little bit and when you were picking teams and stuff. But everybody knew, like, that kid's the one in charge. He's leading us. And then you all fell in line, right? That happened. Like, 7-year-olds are capable of doing that. 7-year-old boys. You get them together in a group and there's going to be a hierarchy. It's not going to be Lord of the Flies. It's going to be this kid's in charge. You all listen to him. Mm-hmm. And we're not allowed to do that in our world at all. You're not allowed to have spontaneous hierarchy formation. I think I wrote about this in my book. But I remember in college, we would every year in Campus Crusade, we'd go and have our, like, fall retreat. And this is, like, 20 years later, still bothers me. And my senior year, they wouldn't let us do it. And this is the thing that, like, got all the guys to come play. We'd come play a tackle football game together. And you would see that, like, playground hierarchy formation.
Yeah,
that would happen there, and they hated it because we didn't let the girl, like, when girls can't play tackle football with you, that's not nice to the girls. They feel excluded, and it's like, no, we just went and did it anyway. But that's like that. I mean, I foresaw the entire future and our entire way of life in that moment. That
right.
Men are not allowed to do exclusivist things. They're not allowed to do things just as men. They can't do things together. They can't have these formations the formation of hierarchy. All right. There's a few places in the business world where this happens, where you have, like, objective criterion, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not a coincidence that sales is still male dominated, and they try as hard as they can to hire female sales women. But it doesn't usually work very well because it's competitive, right? When I did sales every month, right, every sales would be on a spreadsheet and you'd see how much each guy sold, and everybody wants to be at the top. And you knew the guys, like, these guys have been doing it a long time. They have a good, you know, network and everything. And they would always score at the very top. And you're like, I want to be like that guy. Right. I want to build things up to that point where that guy is. And you see it, like, this, the objectivity of it, right? This guy's at the top. You're somewhere down here. And everybody, there was a pecking order, and you knew where you sat in the pecking order, and that would be reflected like when you have team meetings, right? Yeah. The guys that are free to like disagree with the boss are the ones that are pulling in millions of dollars a year. Right? They can say, "We're not doing that. That's stupid." Me, I'd be like, "Yes, sir. Whatever you want, right?" Because yeah. you have right. You are at the place that you're at in the hierarchy, right? That mm-hmm. still exists. That's one of the few. That's also like why sports are actually important. And I mean, we'll talk about sports ball and things like that and how it's, you know, this idolatrous thing and everything else, but it's still objective, right? Somebody wins the Super Bowl every year. Everybody else doesn't, right? Somebody's the best and somebody else mm-hmm. isn't. And our culture doesn't like that. It hates it. Why can't everybody get a participation trophy is like the boomer thing, but they're right about that.
Yeah. So, right I mean, that. A lot of conservatives talk about that and they know it's a problem, but they don't realize that like all of society is like participation trophy thinking, like the entire structure of our liberal democracy. Like, you know how offended people get when you talk about the fact that like women's vote has not been like a good thing for the country? They cannot take it because they have participation trophy viewpoints on politics. This is exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's nuts. But you only have a few minutes left. We should probably finish out this chapter.
Yeah, let me just
if we can
just footnote for this one, and then we'll
okay. The footnote, yeah, 37.
No, I'm on 39. I'm just gonna keep reading okay. the main text. So, we should not ascribe greatness to most of the powerful men in our time. Great men lead other men, and together direct their nation to its destiny. Great men show that heroic masculinity is not simply about protecting the weak, but it is also about leading the whole to greatness. In civil affairs today, men should go their own way. Our moment requires of us to stand against the feminine egalitarian impulse ingrained within us from an early age that views the arc of providence as bending toward equality. Certainly, there is a sort of fundamental equality between men that makes each one his own. But we must not delude ourselves to think that civilizational maturity is measured by its acceleration toward social, political, economic, and expressive equality, and towards the bad fruit of equality, namely inclusivity and universality, as discussed in Chapter 3. The prince must be committed to natural hierarchy, where an individuality is harmonized with hierarchy, exclusivity, which respects difference but keeps it away, and particularism, the conservation of the people's unique cultural features. And he should return us to a masculine society, which alone can remedy the gynocratic contradictions that plague our society. It's interesting, like, you know how you're not supposed to say that, like, our culture is better than the third world cultures that are coming here? And, like,
yeah, you can't say that. It's illegal.
It has to be expressed in terms of whether they're coming here legally or illegally. You can't talk about the fact that these people are not going to bolster our culture. You're not allowed to speak in terms of culture. But the fact that they are leaving cultures where their ancestors did not do as good a job for their people as our ancestors did for us. You can't talk like that at all. And so that's a very feminine way of thinking. And that's what Stephen Wolf's driving at here, is we have a very feminine way of addressing policy issues.
Yeah, the views on immigration, that's participation culture writ large. Right. Yes. Participation trophy culture. It's like, Honduras and Guatemala and every sub-Saharan African country, they're all equal to the United States of America or Great Britain or France. Right. We're all the same. And yeah, I mean, forms respecters comment here is not giving everybody a participation trophy denies the imago.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is how they think, though, is that unless you view every single person exactly the same and, and they're every human being on earth is exactly the same, right? You are denying the imago Dei, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you're doing. And so we've repressed. I mean, you see, I don't know if you saw this, if you're blocked by him or not, but Neil Shenvey was on again and talking about how like woke culture and all the things they believe, that there's white supremacy and patriarchy and all the stuff they believe. He's saying that right wing guys, they just flip that on its head and says, no, there's anti-white race hate and there's a gynocracy and all of this. And they're both wrong. We're in the middle. And it's like, what world are you living in?
Yeah.
Like, what world are you living in, man? They do hate us. They like, They hate white Christian men, period. End of story. That's just reality. And if you can't see that, if you're going to try to find some third way, no, that's absurd, right? God made men to rule, period. That's the world God made. If you don't like it, take it up with him, mm-hmm. right? That is reality. And so having this gynocracy that we very clearly do have is anti-culture. It's destructive, mm-hmm. and it's horrific. It destroys everything in an entire society. And how do you fix it is the question, right? How is it fixed? And that we're going to have to save for next time, I believe. So anything you want to promote before we say goodbye to everyone?
At Contra Mortar on Twitter. And I'm about to stream my third episode for today, which is with Steve Saylor. So that's what I want to promote right now.
Steve said, what's the title of that again? It's
The Spectre of Noticing.
The Spectre of Noticing. So that'd be an interesting one. I'm gonna turn it on as soon as we say goodbye here. And the other one you also did another stream with Chronicles this morning.
John Doyle.
Yeah. So you check those out. We also have the episode with Martyr Made. We went about 2.5 hours, over 2.5 hours with Daryl and with Ron Dodson. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't checked that out yet, that of course is only available to the premium Contramundum army at contramundumpodcast.com. All the people that generously support us, being able to afford microphones that actually work now and streaming software and everything else. So we're very thankful to all of you. So if you go over there, please check that out. Sabaton, we will have more premium content.
We will do it once a month. And if we get enough supporters, maybe we'll do it twice a month. I mean,
more often. Yeah. Because a lot of these we want to, some people, you want to give them an incentive to come on. Like a lot of shows do that. And we're not made of money, unfortunately, thanks to Joe Biden. And I know you aren't either. But we want to be able to bring on more people, and that sometimes that costs some money. But we want to keep doing that. And do we have our next guest? Can we announce our next guest yet? Our next premium?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, he'll be in. Yeah.
He's in. So yeah. Paul Gottfried will be the next one. So we'll have a long form podcast with him and asking questions, and you can get the questions in once we have it on the Substack, on the Shield Stack. So please check that out, and we'll keep those rolling. We're going to keep it going for everyone. This last one went really, really well. It was great. We'll have, maybe we'll, leak out a little clip of it early. We'll see. But until then, I'm attacked by the CIA. My throat. Until then, we hope that you have a wonderful week, and please go to contramundumpodcast.com and subscribe and share this, like this, subscribe, do everything you need to do. And until then, stay peacefully dangerous. Sorry, we're all going to make it. We didn't have time for you today. Maybe next time. But stay peacefully dangerous, and we will see you all next time. Bye. Thank you.